Oh, so my last time this week at the podium, and I need to say, first of all, thank you. It's an incredible thing to go. An incredible thing to have the invitation to look to go look to walk in the narrows, as I said the first time, and really kind of look in and look up and look around. And it's that would have been enough. Hinei Matov, right? There's the song. That would have been enough just to give me a chance to do that, but to do that and then have these people listen so well. That would have been enough, but not only, but then people to come and share stories and share quotations and share things that a talk reminds them of. It's just all a great, great blessing. So thank you. I know because some of you have told me, but I suspect a lot of you are interested in just what's going on back home at my church in the neighborhood. I just got off the phone. That's one reason Don was getting ready to start to send a search party after me. The gathering last night was good, and there was a very, very important conversation with my colleague and a key adult. The adult who's got her pain. From long ago, and it was good. Moved to a good place, and it's still moving, and it will continue. So I again claim that God is at work. So we're moving in the right direction. Thank you for continuing. And there's one other thing I feel a need. Do in this last talk, and that is to really give honor to my mother. Her name was Sally, and mom died over 20 years ago. Died too young from my son, from her son's perspective. I move on with stories and take it for granted, but the truth is that if we're going to talk about my journey and my journey in love, you gotta have Sally there. She's so important. And just to share a story around her passing. Our family had gathered a few days before. My siblings and I are scattered across the country. At that time, a couple of us were in Boston, one was in Los Angeles, one was in Nebraska, and mom and dad were in Des Moines, Iowa still. And we gathered for, I think, a 40th wedding anniversary for my parents. It was an early celebration. It was a month later, the actual day, but it was convenient, if not ordained. That we would gather early, and we were all there. At that point, three of us were married, and our spouses were with us. My younger brother was there with the woman that he is now married to, and there were just two grandkids at that point, and they were there. And it was this blessing of a time to be together. And at the very end, actually, some of us had gone home, but at the end of my little brother's stay with my parents, he and his girlfriend announced that they were engaged, which meant some phone calls to everybody. We had just been together, but it meant phone calls. And mom called me, I think that was Tuesday night, gave me the news, short conversation. It was great, happy news. The next night, Wednesday night, when I would typically be at church, but it was the very, very beginning of September and things hadn't cranked up yet. And I was home. And mom meant to call my sister, but she hit the wrong number on the speed dial, and got me. And we had this longer conversation, reveling in the good news, but her also just talking about how much she valued all of us. And it made her very happy that we each had somebody, had a partner that she liked and loved, and just felt like she could rest with that. You know, that was really good. After that wonderful long conversation and exchange of mutual love, went to bed and then got a call. Well, late the next day, she had serious health incident. She was having an aneurysm. She died fairly quickly, which was a shock to all of us, me. But that conversation where her finger went to the other number was a great gift from God. And there's another piece to the story. Of course, we gathered again, having just been in Des Moines, but we all gathered again. And the night before the funeral, we all spoke at the funeral. The night before, I had a dream. And my mother was in this dream. A couple things you should know about her. One, she loved kids, loved to play with kids. And in the last some years of her life, she had circulation issues, so often it was hard for her to walk. We were going somewhere as a small group, as a family. She'd say, "Now, don't wait for me. Keep going." But, you know, of course, we're going to wait for her. It's Mom, you know. Our friends, by the way, thought she was so cool. They decided she was one of the Ramones. You know, if you know the Ramones, there's Joey Ramone and Dee Dee Ramone, and they called her Sally Ramone, you know, which was great honoring. Believe me, just trust me. You know, but she had those issues. But in my dream, there's this group of kids coming over the hill, dancing, singing, and with her was my mom. Keeping up with them just fine. Dancing and singing and playing with the kids, coming over this hill and then off over another hill. Which gave me peace going into the funeral and knowing where and how she was going. Just a little bit more of that story. The sadness for me, there's grief, of course. The sadness at the time was, while Lorraine and I were really hoping to have children, we didn't have them yet. And I thought, oh, you know, I really wanted them to know Grandma Sally. But the growth that came out of that was that I realized that, well, that's up to me. Going to be up to me to live Sally, to live that love as best I can. Tell them about her. There was a little book she brought for whatever grandkid we would have first. And she bought and she gave to us, and we showed them all that book. But you know, that would be upon us, upon me, in our family, in our the kids. Elizabeth's middle name is Sally, by the way. But when Lizzie, my oldest, was maybe three or four, and she had questions about Grandma Sally, and I would tell her about Grandma Sally, and you know, she wished she could meet her. And one morning she woke up and she was very, very, very excited. And she came in and she said, "Daddy, I saw Grandma Sally." Very happy. I said, "It's great, honey. In your dream, what was she doing?" "Well, she was dancing with all these children." So I just want to remember Grandma Sally today and honor her. And as I mentioned before, she shaped me in this life, and I feel like she continues to shape me and my children as well. So a song. It's a little tricky, but I think we can do it. This was written by a friend of mine. Dan, could you give me an F chord by chance? And I'm going to do my best.
He loves African. We are going to a place where music falls and fills up and breathes. We are going to a place where music And though it might be a long time, I know it's gonna be all right. 'Cause we've already started to
Let's pray. Such a journey, God, such a rich, rich journey. Thank you for that. Thank you for your work that continues. Thank you for the joy that awaits. Thank you for the joy that we can sing about right now on the way. Speaking of long journeys, Hebrews 12 and 13. It's basically a sermon. They call it a general epistle. It's an exhortation. And it comes at a time a little bit later in the early church, after a time when people are really thinking Jesus is coming back right now, any minute, right here, and then thinking, well, we may be settling in a little bit for the long haul. So the writer of Hebrews, at this point in chapter 11, says, all right, let's think about where we've come from. Let's think about Adam. Let's think about Abram. Let's think about Noah. Let's think about there was this saint and this person and this person and this. And we think of that witness over time. And talks about the example of Jesus. And says at the beginning of chapter 12, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race. Somebody's running. That's good. I thought about asking for some sound effects. That's good. And let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. And he goes on, the writers go on to elaborate. And I want to bring up the spring at it became important to me in thinking about long races to look at this a little bit and also look at how this sermon elaborates what running the race with perseverance, what it looks like. So consider also chapter 13. Let mutual love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing that some have entertained angels without knowing it. Remember those who are in prison as though you were in prison with them. Let marriage be held in honor by all, and let the marriage bed be kept undefiled. Keep your lives free from the love of money, and be content with what you have. Let us run that race with perseverance. In these last minutes, what I want to do is talk about what next. I was blessed by my denomination, by my board of pensions, with a program they call Credo. They bring pastors together in a retreat setting for a week, those who have been at it a certain number of years and still have at least a certain number of years left. And it is a time to kind of take stock and discern and heal and get support and look at a number of dimensions of our vocations. It's an incredible gift, and I got to do that in Louisiana in May. And it was a time, I've been at this place a long time, you know, 22 years. And, you know, what next? What next, God? Here? And I want to share a little bit that came out of that. But before naming that, I want to circle back, because these pieces fit together for me. I want to circle back to that marveling bit and marveling at people in particular. And there's a story from a very, very wise monk named Thomas Merton that I want to share. And Merton had an important moment in his life that the shorthand for which is now the Louisville Epiphany. Maybe some of you have read about it. He talks about it. He was a monk in a remote part of Kentucky, but every once in a while he would need to go in to do some errands, some chores in the city, the much, much bigger city of Louisville. And one day he was, I think, going to a print shop. And he was at the corner of 4th and Walnut. And I know that because you can go into downtown Louisville today, and if you go to 4th and Walnut, there's a marker. Pretty neat. That's the Merton Epiphany right here. And he came out of the shop, and there were people out there, of course, because it's a city. But people appeared to him. There was a light that shone from each one of them. And he writes that, I believe I saw them as God sees them, each dazzling, brilliant, bright, marvelous. And it was a turning point for his own vocation, because from that, while he's still, you know, dedicated time to solitude and quiet and lots of writing, there was a dimension of loving the world and loving these people whose names he did not know that became much, much more important. And he engaged that in his writing and engaged that in his ministry. And that's one reason his name is more well known to many of us these days. A lover of the world, a lover of peace, a lover of justice, lover of God, and a lover of the cosmic dance, which I'll mention more about later. So people around us dazzle, including people whose names we do not know, and including people who are different from me. Another person whose writings are becoming more and more important to me is a rabbi from the UK, Jonathan Sacks. And he writes, The supreme spiritual challenge for our age is this: to see God's image in those who are not in our image. The supreme spiritual challenge for our age: to see God's image in those who are not in our image. You can hear that. That's a need in my neighborhood. That's a need, a challenge in my city. And I don't think I'm going too far out on a limb to say that's a need and a challenge for our world. And for me, part of the call, the continuing call, is to build connections between people and with people, particularly people who are different. In whatever form, theology, neighborhood, culture, race, religion, creed, denomination. It's hard work. But it is a call of God, I believe. A year or so ago, a woman worshiped with us, for a couple of months. She's the parent of a member of our church. And this woman is a real free spirit. So she's an American citizen, but she isn't in the country that much. She goes off to other places teaching English. Yeah, usually teaching English. So she's lived in Dubai. She's taught in Thailand. She's been in many different places in South America, and she'll teach a place for a while and kind of come back to the country and check in on her son and her daughter-in-law who are in our church and kind of go somewhere else. Lovely lady, free spirit. And so there was a time she was with us for a couple of months and worshiping with us and getting to know our people and getting to know our community. And she said, "I want to take you to lunch." So she did. There was a wonderful Thai place she really liked. It was great. And we went there, and she brought with her this beautiful piece of pottery. Not real big, but just exquisite. The design was incredible. And she really wanted me to see it. And then she wanted to tell me the story of it. And I think she got it in Dubai, somewhere in the Middle East, but I'm not sure about that. And she told me how she was just in a place with vendors, and she saw this older gentleman, and he had this incredible pottery, and it was just the most beautiful thing she had seen, and she bought one. And I thought, oh my gosh, is she going to give me this? And she wasn't, you know? which is as it should be. But she wanted me to see it, and to see it as this beautiful creation, this beautiful piece of art. And she showed that and told me the story, and I'm nodding my head, and she said, "I think your church community is your beautiful creation. That is your art." Now, of course, theologically, I'm a little bit different. I think it's the Holy Spirit's creation. I also think that our community, I mean, please don't leave this camp thinking it's just, you know, it's the kingdom all done right there, because there's plenty of stuff. It's a church after all, right? And churches are made up of people. And so just be clear about that. But it touched me greatly for her to see kind of the beauty of different people coming together, to see that community. And it's not huge, you know, it's 100, 125. I mean, you know, you got your membership rolls, it's 150, but there are 100 people coming and it's changing, and then the neighbors are their own kind of part of it. And, you know, it's this organism that, not huge, but where I do believe people, not necessarily in each other's image, but definitely all in God's image, are working on connections, working on a deeper relationships, and trying to let light shine, and trying to see that brilliant light in each other, that light that Merton saw. So it touched me greatly that she saw that as a creative, artistic, beautiful thing. And that image was with me when I was in Louisiana doing my own discernment about next. What next? And our community changes a lot because it's the city and people come and live for a while. They finish grad school and they move. Or a young couple may be there and they have a child and the child gets older and they don't quite trust Boston schools and they move to a suburb. You know, it changes. That's part of who we are, and that's all right. Living and breathing organism. And I will tell you that what I came out of that week thinking this is still where I belong. And it's exciting to me that art work is not done. But there's another piece too that came out of that week. And I need to mention that now. And it was a piece that became strong this spring. I mentioned early on that part of my work is working with this organizing group called GBIO. My wife calls it my unpaid job, you know, because it takes a lot of energy. I mean, I feel like it is part of the ministry. And some of that, it, again, as I mentioned before, it's people from different denominations and different faiths finding common concerns and trying to work together on that. And that's a good thing to do. As important as it is to work on those issues, what's most precious to me is that we're building relationships with each other. And that is enriching for me. I also think it's good for democracy. And for me, that's a spiritual thing. Remember Walt Whitman, the procession of souls. That's a spiritual thing. Through this work, I have gotten to know leaders, a lot of Jewish leaders, and now I'm starting to meet some Muslim leaders. And we're trying to sit down and develop relationships. And in fact, some Jewish leaders took me on that trip to Israel last summer. And I got to know Rabbi Ron well. And we came back and we wanted to be intentional about gathering some clergy together to meet regularly. And it included a lot of clergy that were pretty busy. Reverend Nancy Taylor at Old South, Reverend Ray Hammond, who has kind of led the Boston Miracle with violence issues, Bethel AME Church, the Imam, Imam Webb, who has his own very interesting story, grew up in Oklahoma, son or grandson of a Pentecostal preacher, but he got involved in gang stuff. And Islam was a path to peace for him. Some other rabbis, anyway, a number of folks, and we just met. We were meeting once a month, carving out that time just so we could swap congregational stories in part. They're kind of the same things, you know. You've got your grumblers, you've got the leaders, you know. That was kind of fun to discover. But also sharing our stories and our paths and trying to go deeper, go further out in understanding people's relationship with God. And we're doing that work. And then April comes along, right? And the marathon happens. So now some of you know, I have actually a little bit of a relationship with the marathon. I've run it, I will say 6.5 times. You know? I've run it with somebody in my church as a fundraiser. A lot of you have gotten those letters and responded, thank you. I say 6.5 because a couple years ago after an injury, I thought, all right, I'm not going to do 26 again, but I'll do 13.1. So Deacon Peter and I split it, you know. And my hope actually was to do that again this year. But I had a bum knee and couldn't happen this year. Peter did run it, and he finished 6 minutes before the explosions. You know, there are people from New England here in the Boston area, so I know we all have our stories of connecting. You know, we do. And I don't know that mine are more special than anybody else's. You could just get in a circle and share. Well, I know so-and-so who was there, and I know this person. I know I was getting a lot of phone calls that day. All those folks that had received my fundraising letters, they were calling back, you know, to say, from all over the country, saying, are you okay? And I was fine. You know, I was fine. I can tell you, and just as these stories are happening, two moments where it hit me the most, and it hit me very, very deeply. The first was the next day when I realized, and I got a call from a parishioner, and she told me that her family was very close with the Richard family. And this is the family that lost the boy. Both families in Dorchester, and two sons about the same age, which means they had been in many soccer seasons together, and they had been in many Little League seasons. That winter, they had just skied together in a Boston program. And indeed, Martin was supposed to be on Aiden's baseball team in May, you know. And so that family lost a boy, the mother lost a limb, the daughter lost a limb, the father lost or had hearing injury. And then there was one boy who had no physical injury, but of course, there's its own emotional injury of everybody else in the family being injured. So this affected this family in my church very, very deeply. And that was, oh my God, it just felt so close. That was one time. The next time was a few days later, once we knew more about the suspect and the perpetrator, I can now say, perpetrators. And then immediately I thought of my friend Yusufi, a young man, bright man, trained in organizing, who's gone deeper in his faith through the organizing and has accepted a job with the New Islamic Center of Boston to try to kind of nurture this community and help them. He's a really smart guy, heart of gold. And I thought, this young man, and he's young, he's going to get besieged by press and maybe more. And that was the second time I wept. The first time was when I talked to Kathy Berger. And the second time was when I realized Yusufi. But this group that had been meeting, we were then meeting more and having conference calls and helping Yusufi through this and being in relationship with the imam. And we were already planning an interfaith service. And of course, one was getting planned at higher levels than us, politically speaking, when the governor was calling for that, and then the president was going to come. So our plans got shifted once those guys got involved. But the basic thrust was there, and we lobbied with them to say, well, we really want to make sure Nancy Taylor is there because her church is at the finish line, and she's ministering to runners and injured runners as we speak. We want her there, and they complied and involved her. And we really wanted Rabbi Ron there because he has an important congregation, and he's been in these relationships. So we had those folks there, and that was really, really, really important. And Reverend Liz Walker, and you may remember her from the news, she's now becoming a Presbyterian pastor, actually, and I'm tutoring her with her polity. We really wanted her there, and she was there being a chaplain to the city, if not the country. It was a powerful service. And those relationships, which we were just beginning to nurture, deepened. And the piece for me, which some of you have brought up to me, is that okay? The Friday after that event would have been prayer day at the mosque, but that was the shutdown day. Everything is shut down in Boston, so they didn't have prayers. They couldn't have prayers. The following Friday, they were having their prayers together for the first time after all of these events, and the imam called me and asked if I would come to their prayer service, just to be there, say a few words. You know. And they invited Rabbi Ron there too. And we came. And Rabbi Ron and I were there, and actually another rabbi came with him, and we were brought up at the end and said a little bit. And this is its own diverse group. You know, Islam is not a monolith. There are these super duper educated folks from Morocco that are going to MIT and Somalians that are just trying to get by working in the parking lots all over town. You know, like, it's this real mix. They were all, though, so grateful for that. And I just had one. I had this incredible procession of souls coming to me and thanking me. But up there, of course, I did the natural thing. I hugged Ron and I hugged the imam. And unbeknownst to me, there was press there. And the Globe got a big picture. So I open up the paper on Saturday, and there's the picture of me just giving Imam Webb a big hug. And as Jim says, it was kind of a CFO hug, you know, just kind of boom. And I still wasn't sure how all this was going to play in Boston, but it played well. And I feel like our city is handling it well, as best we can. And those relationships and that respect and even that love between people who are not in my image, even though they are in God's image, is precious and important. One other piece. Our organization had planned a public meeting. We planned it a couple of months before. It's because there was a special election for Senate going on. And the two key candidates were Representative Markey, now Senator Markey, and Representative Lynch. And when there's a race like that, we call them into a gathering and we have representatives of our congregations and we say, this is where we are, this is what we are concerned about, you know, will you work with us on these issues? And we had been planning that, but it had to change. It had to change with the events. We couldn't be in that same kind of thing. There was too much healing, but we still needed to pray. In fact, we needed to pray more. And we also needed to name that we're concerned not only about that violence, but the other violence that goes by without the same kind of publicity in many of our neighborhoods. Like the violence going on in my neighborhood this summer, and in Roxbury, and in Dorchester. So, you know, we named that. And then Pastor Ray had us all just turn to our neighbor and pray. And that meant you had a Jewish woman praying with Muslim man. It meant you had candidates for public office praying with whoever was nearby. In my case, Stephen Lynch prayed with me, who's a representative from South Boston. And we know each other a little bit. And we're in our minute of prayer there. I'm praying for him, and I'm praying for the campaign, and I'm praying for the country, and I'm praying for our city. And he prays for my wife, you know. And our gathering. And I left that, and I like this work anyway, but I came out of that work, and our organization came out of that work, is that we need more of this deeper relational work. We're going internal, that's how we say it. You know, we're going to try to pull back on some issues for the next 6 months and really have more relationships with each other. Because that is, if not the supreme challenge, it's certainly a supreme challenge to connect, to know, to see the image of God in the one who's not in the image of me. And this is work for the long run. So part of my discernment coming out of that Louisiana time is that I've got my small community. That work is important every day. But I'm in a position where I can help do that kind of connecting and work with the Holy Spirit as best I can to do that connecting in our city. And I think that's where I'm called right now. I'm not sending out my resume, you know, for a couple of years, you know, in the next couple of years. I'm, you know, there's a lot of connecting to do there. I need to wrap up. And I want to mention, you know, I'm taking a long view. And I'm thinking of Hebrews. By the way, I didn't show you my marathon shirt. We had this one. And then we've got me and a couple of other folks running the marathon. Thanks to Dan Wasserman, the cartoonist, did this for us. And it's about the long run. And it's worth paying attention to what Hebrews says about, it's not just about how we do that, how we put one foot in front of the other on this way, on the way of Jesus, I confess. Let mutual love continue. Visit the prisoners. It's the stuff we've heard before, right? Welcome strangers. There's angels unaware. So we continue. And to step back even more in this long run, I love that even though I can't always see it, and sometimes I may not even be working with it properly, I know that the pulse is continuing. I know that God is at work and God is present. And I'm going to keep working in these communities, but I know that kind of God is at work in bigger ways. And both the Boyle book that I've mentioned before and a sermon that Dick Baer gave me refer to Merton again. And Merton talks about the cosmic dance, this God at work. And even, well, let me just read this part. Merton writes, "No despair of ours can alter the reality of things or stain the joy of the cosmic dance, which is always there." That dance. And Winnie seems like the right place to talk about dance. That dance. Dance is continuing. Two stories. At least one of them is quick. this story. I've already told you. I do theater with kids in our neighborhood every Tuesday afternoon during the school year. It's my privilege to direct these kids. And you heard about the Music Man. We've celebrated that. A couple years ago, we do a lot of these. Like we rehearse them in 10 weeks. Take a break and do another one. You know, it's 5, 6, and 7 year olds. We do very edited versions of these shows, and it's all good, you know, it's all good. Just like the end of The Music Man, you know, when they're all playing and it sounds horrible, but the parents are in the audience and they say, "Oh, there's my Johnny on the trombone. It's so beautiful." That's what all of our plays are like, okay? And once I figured that out, I could just rest and relax. Like, okay, whatever they do, this is going to be delightful. I'm good, you know? But we were doing Godspell. And I don't always try to go for heavy drama, right? But you can't do Godspell without the crucifixion, you know, and the resurrection after that. So we're doing that, and an older kid is playing Jesus on the cross. And the way I do Godspell, I just have all the kids. In this case, it's about 35. They're all part of the disciples. So they're in Gethsemane, okay, up on the stage, and they're supposed to be sleeping, right? That's the idea. You guys, you're asleep, and you're in Gethsemane. This very dramatic thing is happening. Jesus has been arrested. This is happening. But, you know, with six-year-olds, they don't necessarily get the difference between real life and theater life. So they'll be in Gethsemane, and they'll see Aunt Mary, and they go, okay, like that, you know. But in this case, I'm trying to say, okay, you're asleep. You're asleep, and they lie down. But really, for them, in public view, this is a giant sleepover, right? So you hear lots of giggling, lots of giggling. They're giggling in Gethsemane, okay? Now, theatrically, I would like them to get a clue, you know? But theologically, they're saying something that's really good. They're saying, despite the stain, at some level, they kind of know the end of the story. That giggling in Gethsemane, I would never direct that with a group of adults, but for this, kind of worked in its own way. And then this other story. Oh, Denby, a couple minutes? I'll try to talk. Oh, okay. All right. Just because this. Okay, all right, fair. Fair, fair. Okay. In Africa, I told you about the school in the slum, Homoni. Right away, in the way the teachers would work, they have these guest volunteers, and they say, Reverend Burns, will you now teach our class? You know, they just kind of put me in charge. And they did that with my kids, too, and with Lorraine. And in this case, there was a full class, you know, 45 minutes or something, and the kids are just packed in these little chairs, packed in little room, little chairs. And I'm going to guess they're six-year-olds or so, six and seven. Same kind of age as the gigglers in Gethsemane. And she wants me to tell them a Bible story. And the one was on my mind was a call, you know, Samuel calling David. And I told that, and I tried to milk it and enrich it. But it was still just 5 minutes, you know. And I got at least a half an hour to go. So I decided, okay, we are going to do the annotated creation story. You know, really do this out. And of course, English is one language they're learning, but it's not their mother tongue. They're learning Swahili, they have their own mother tongue, and they're learning English. And so I need to keep the English simple. So I go through each day of creation, and I want them to be the voice of God. So I say, you know, day one, God does this, God sees it, and God says, it is good. You know, at heart, I'm still a mind, too, so I'm trying to do this very clearly. It is good. I say that with me and go, it is good. That's how they would say it, you know, and they got into it very much each day, and they would just move with one breath and one rhythm and go, it is good, and I got through the days of creation. There's still a lot of time left, you know. So then I go through each child and have them stand up and say, tell me his name. His name is William. William, God made William, and God saw William and said, it is good. I didn't go into the he, she pronouns. I was just keeping it simple. It is good. You know, keep that same refrain going with every child, and there were 30-some kids. And then we did the teachers. You know, it is good. And it was really fun. You know, we had a good time. Then we sang some songs. They just sang with gusto. It was great. And then throughout the day, I would see some of these kids around the campus, and they go, hello, eat is good. You know, they just go around doing it. Eat is good. Well, that was day one, and I think, maybe it was day three, and I was kind of tired. We were adjusting to the time zone, and it was kind of hot. We closed the windows because we were all afraid of mosquitoes and, you know, and learning to sleep with a net. And anyway, not sleeping well, a bit tired. So I'm on the campus, you know, just kind of hunched over a little bit, sitting down, trying to rest, and feeling a little weary. And evidently, I looked a little weary because this group of kids came to me. 3, 4, 5, I don't know, this group of kids. These kids that I had come to minister to, right? It's the wealthy North American. I'm coming to help them. These kids come to me. I'm looking kind of ragged. And they go around me and they go, it is good. And that wasn't enough, so they did it again. It is. And again and again, and a couple of other kids enjoying them. Like, again, an insta prayer circle, you know. They're just around me telling me, you are good. It is good. The cosmic dance is good. And with that, I could do the rest of our trip. I could make it home. And we can continue this ministry as best we can with God's grace. Amen.